This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Chris Hedges' published bio is impressive. It is incredible. It is inspiring. It tells you the story or gives you a quick glimpse of a part of the story of the fascinating journey of one of the world's most brilliant public intellectuals. That journey has taken Dr. Hedges to places most of us gathered in this room have only read about, places most of us would never dream of going. Indeed, some places some of us would never dare to go, places some of us can't even locate on a map. The Balkans, Serbia, Bosnia, Gaza, Iran, Afghanistan, not for vacations in peacetime, but during wars in those countries, during combat, as a journalist covering the insanity of human inhumanity towards other humans, from the Sandinista Somocista conflict in Nicaragua to the FMLN, Frente Farabunda Martí para la Liberación de Nicaragua Nacional in El Salvador, Chris Hedges' grasp, although he is titled and known as a Pulitzer Prize journalist, his grasp of the realities that lie underneath the political lies and the corporate-controlled media hype make him a misfit as a so-called, quote, embedded journalist. Embedded journalists are those who are only allowed to spoon-feed a gullible public disinformation and misinformation as to how our side is winning as we fight to defend freedom and democracy across this globe. Chris's indescribably gargantuan intellect and his unwavering integrity have given him insights that every critical thinking person with a love and respect for honesty need to hear or to read. One way of trying to describe him or introduce him is to say that his mind travels at warp speed in the same rarefied atmosphere as Hannah Arendt and her concern for the connection between ethics and politics, Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, Henry Giroux, James Cohn, Cornel West, Katie Cannon, W.E.B. Du Bois, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, and the South African theologian Alan Buzak. That's the kind of intellectual and insightful company Chris Hedges keeps. But that is not how I want to describe Chris or introduce Chris. I want to introduce you to a man who not only has academic and experiential credentials as a journalist and as a prolific writer, who is at the same time a critical thinking, you don't find that quality among too many journalists. I want to introduce you to a man who has a Master of Divinity degree from Harvard Divinity School. He is an academically trained clergy person, but beyond the academic credentials, Chris is a minister whose personality was shaped by the integrity of his father, Reverend Thomas Hedges, who was an ordained Presbyterian minister and pastor, and who taught Chris by example what the perfect combination of head and heart looks like on the ground. Head and heart is borrowed from Howard Thurman's autobiography. Thomas Hedges, Chris's dad, was a white minister of modest privilege who showed his son Chris what loving all of God's children, white, black, brown, Asian, looked like in a country where racial hatred, white supremacy, and bigotry were as commonplace as apple pie in the 4th of July. Chris's intellect and integrity were forged in the furnace of his father's home, the classrooms of Colgate and Harvard, and the classroom of life, with a merciful God touching the soul of Chris to make him a genuinely unique human being. I want you to meet a man who, while interviewing a soldier in the midst of combat, when the soldier started crying, seeing death up close and personal will make you cry. Seeing your buddies cut in half by explosive devices or machine gun fire will make you cry if you have any shred of humanity left inside of you that the military has not drained out of you. And when Chris saw the soldier's tears, he folded up his notes, put his pen away, and stopped the interview because he was not the kind of journalist to capitalize on somebody else's pain or sensationalize something very sensitive. His allegiance in countless moments like that was to ministry and not media. I want you to meet a man who writes about risks other people take in a culture that hates and kills Muslims. I was sharing with Chris back in the green room. I was trying to find out where I read this or if I just heard him talk about it. One man risking his life to see that a baby born in a Muslim home got fresh milk every day. The enemy set the milk out and used it as target practice for any Muslims who came out to try to get it. And this one old guy made sure he smuggled the milk in to a Muslim baby whom he had been taught to hate as Muslims because he wanted to know how the little one was doing. I want you to meet a man who does not chill out watching television every night and who, if I remember that two-hour interview on the Author of the Month program on C-SPAN, doesn't even have a television in his home. He has no blog, he has no website, but who spends 3 to 4 hours every evening reading and writing. I don't want to introduce to you, I just want to present to you my friend and my brother, Dr. Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. I expect Dr. Wright, although I haven't asked him, spent his adolescence in his daddy's church doing what I did in my daddy's church, which was proving that I could raise hell better than any other kid in the congregation. I was a headache, and he probably was too. But I can't think of any better formation to become a preacher. Great preachers, like Dr. Wright, always raise hell. They unsettle us. They challenge us. They speak the truth when no one else does. They stand up for justice. They defy the privileged and the powerful on behalf of the oppressed. They know that the measure of our lives as individuals and as a nation is reflected in how we treat those who suffer and endure injustice. And they do not follow the expedient and the easy path. They leave that to others, to the careerists, the ambitious, the selfish. The Romans, who Dr. Wright correctly reminds us were white, it was Jesus who was a person of color, don't like preachers any more today than they did 2,000 years ago. They seek every way possible to silence them, for the truth spoken by these preachers terrifies them. And when the dust settles on this period in human history, when we go back and look at who had moral courage and who did not, who stood up for justice and who did not, who spoke the truth no matter what the cost, all the detractors and critics of Dr. Wright, all those who betrayed him, will wither into moral insignificance. When you are as brilliant and eloquent as Dr. Wright, when you have that kind of talent, Satan is always there to tempt you to misuse it, to deny your faith, to sell your freedom. Satan offers fame and money. He offers you the road to privilege and power. The kingdoms of the world glitter in front of you with their splendor. Bow down, worship me, and it is yours, Satan whispers. Is there any clearer passage in the Bible that illustrates that imperialism is the work of the devil? Power, ultimately, is the power to kill, the negative power of death. But there is another road in life. This is the road of faith, of justice, and truth. It is the road we are called by the Lord to take. One road offers to us the illusion of greatness, the chant of the crowd, the emotions of the mass, the ability to use the mechanisms of the state to take life. The other road offers the isolated, lonely journey taken by those of conscience. There are many who are seduced by Satan, who spend their lives building pathetic monuments to themselves. They find out too late that Satan has tricked them. Then the rise to power, they are steadily diminished, like Shakespeare's Richard III, until they are nothing more than power's pawn. Dr. Wright never sold his freedom, and he has had many offers. He bent down and he picked up the cross. He felt the weight dig into his shoulders. He placed the crown of thorns on his head. He started down the hard road, walked by the preachers and saints before him, the road walked by Martin and Malcolm, the road that still has the footprints of our Lord. He heard again the words of ridicule and derision, because the Romans were sore, sore afraid. But he did not stop. He has not stopped. He embodies within him the power and the glory Satan cannot break. In the Gospel of Matthew, when Satan left Jesus, who was hungry and exhausted in the wilderness, angels came to Jesus and anointed Jesus to preach the word of God. And that word tonight, in the preacher before us, lives and breathes, and so do the angels who stand by him. Two years ago, Joe Sacco and I, the graphic illustrator, began work on a book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, that went into the sacrifice zones of our country, those places where the poor and the oppressed have been broken and forgotten. We went into those zones because we understood that all of the impediments to corporate capitalism had been destroyed. All of the movements that had protected the oppressed had been demolished. I teach in a prison, and I always try and write up a course description which is as innocuous as possible to get past the prison administration. And so I proposed teaching a course on American history, which was approved, and then I went out and bought every inmate a copy of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Joe Sacco came and sat on the class, and he said, "Boy, you're so lucky. None of these guys come." And I would hear those inmates, they segregate the prisons in New Jersey by gang affiliation. So this was a Bloods prison, African-American. And Zinn is cognizant of the African-American experience from the beginning of that book to the end. And I'd hear him, I'd give 90-minute talks. I found out after the first class that trying to run a seminar in a prison always ended up being a discussion about the hood, which was sort of interesting for me, but defeated the point of going into the prison. So after that, it was 90-minute lectures, and you have to raise your hand. But I'd hear the inmates go, "Damn, damn, we've been lied to." The brilliance and importance of that book is that Zinn lays out that our founding fathers, most of whom, of course, were slaveholders, never wanted a popular democracy. The goal was to create a mechanism by which that popular democracy would never come into being. That's why so many people were disenfranchised, whether it was Native Americans, African Americans, women, people without property. And that the struggle in American history has always been that fight on behalf of movements that never achieved formal positions of power to open up the space and create room for those who had been denied space. That's what the abolitionist movement was. That's what the labor movement was. That's what the women's suffragist movement was. And that, of course, is what the civil rights movement was. None of these movements ever achieved formal power. And yet, one could argue that at least until he was assassinated in 1968, the most powerful political figure in the United States was Dr. Martin Luther King. Because when he went to Memphis or Selma, 50,000 people went with him. And starting in World War I, and I write a lot about this in the book Death of the Liberal Class, there was a concerted effort on the part of the power elite to destroy movements. In World War I, there was no support for the war. Again, Wall Street pressured the Wilson administration into the war because with the breakdown in Tsarist Russia and the collapse of the Eastern Front, there was the capacity of the Germans to ship over 100,000 troops onto the Western Front and defeat the British and the French. And because Wall Street had lent so much money to the British and the French, they knew that that defeat would mean they would never be repaid. And what was created at that moment was the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, the Creel Commission. And the reason it's so important is because it employed the understanding of mass or crowd psychology pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and of course Sigmund Freud. The people were not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion. And you can go back and see the blueprints for this, Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion. That's where you get the term manufacturing consent, Edward Bernays, which is the father of modern public relations. And so you build this massive propaganda machine. It has its own news division, which is pumping out pro-war stories that all newspapers have to print, its own film division, making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, its speakers' bureaus. And Lippmann argues correctly, Wilson wants to use the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. And he said, in fact, we can seduce the masses to support the war effort. And there's a writer I like very much, Dwight MacDonald, who writes of this period that the war was the rock on which these popular movements were broken. You had a few figures that resisted Randolph Bourne, Eugene V. Debs, the socialist candidate for president who Wilson puts in prison, Jane Addams, but most, and you find that in the writings of Addams of Bourne, most even intellectuals are seduced by this propaganda effort. And what happens after the war, I think, changes irrevocably the character of American society, because all of these propagandists move to Madison Avenue and start working on behalf of corporations. And the dreaded Hun instantly becomes the dreaded Red. So that social movements become tarred with either being soft or front groups for communism and destroyed. That's how the Wobblies are destroyed. That's how Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman are deported. That's how Big Bill Haywood has to flee the country. Joe Hill is hung. Ultimately, that's how, of course, figures like Paul Robeson become pariahs. I mean, in the end, not only is his passport taken from him, Robeson can't even get engagements in African-American churches. And at that moment, we began to essentially have the mechanism that made that opening within our democracy severely weakened and I think ultimately destroyed. MacDonald said that we entered after World War I a psychosis of permanent war, by which he meant we were constantly attempting to ferret out the internal and the external enemy. And he said none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, had anticipated this psychosis of permanent war, this ability, in McDonald's words, to get the masses to call for their own enslavement. So what happens is that the liberal class in a capitalist democracy, which was never designed to be the political left, it was designed to make incremental and piecemeal reform possible. It was designed as a kind of safety valve. That's what happened in the New Deal with the breakdown of capitalism. You had traditional liberals like Roosevelt or his vice president, Henry Wallace, who institute programs that right the system. When Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I think that's right. But at the same time, we were destroying the movements that were the counterweight that put pressure on the liberal center to respond. We were hollowing out those liberal institutions themselves, culminating in the 1950s with the McCarthy hearings and the loss of thousands of jobs for university professors, high school teachers, social workers. It used to be that social workers, their union advocated on behalf of their clients, writers, directors, musicians, journalists like I.F. Stone. That's how Stone becomes a pariah. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine. And at that point, the mechanisms by which we had opened up our democracy, created a middle class, were irrevocably destroyed. Cornel West, I think, points out correctly that the civil rights movement was a legal victory. But King certainly, along with Malcolm, understood that if there was not economic justice, there would never be racial justice. And while that very sort of tenuous link between white northern liberals and the civil rights movement was able to be forged around legal issues, the economic justice that King knew was absolutely fundamental to overcoming racial injustice never came to fruition. And what you had was a kind of ascendancy of maybe the upper third of African Americans, and one would have to argue, and we spent time in Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, for the bottom two-thirds of African Americans, life actually is probably worse. And for me, one of the importance of the Occupy movement was that it raised again this issue of economic justice, of inequality. Michelle Alexander, by the way, has done a tremendous book on this on New Jim Crow, the way you go back and use a legal system to disenfranchise. I was just in Alabama, and 34% of African-American men in the state of Alabama don't have the right to vote. It's exactly the same technique that is that we saw with Jim Crow laws after Reconstruction. So this essentially left us without the mechanisms, without the movements, without the capacity to defend ourselves. And corporate capitalism, we talk a lot about American values. I think it's important to understand that these propagandists have inverted traditional values of thrift, of self-effacement, of hard work, and of course replaced it with a cult of the self, with hedonism, with consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. And I think when we talk about American values, that's what we're really talking about, our corporate values. And they began this steady assault on whatever mechanisms or impediments there were to unfettered corporate capitalism were demolished, lifted, and destroyed, so that by the 1970s, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, we began to shift from what he calls an empire of production to an empire of consumption. In other words, we began to borrow, both to maintain a level of consumption and an imperium that we could no longer afford. I mean, we have not paid for the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And who does the corporate state expect to pay for it? Well, we can see with a physical cliff that that, of course, is going to be brought out on the backs of working men and women and on the poor. $16 trillion looted out of the U.S. Treasury by banks massive loans to fund two wars that, under post-Nuremberg laws, preemptive war is defined as a criminal war of aggression. It is illegal. We have no right as a nation to even debate the terms of the occupation, is about to be taken out on the underclass and on those people who are already hanging on by their fingertips. Half of this country, of course, lives in poverty or near poverty. And so Sacco and I wanted to, rather than write a polemic about unfettered, unregulated corporate capitalism and what it does, go into the places where communities, individuals, families, the environment had all been forced to kneel before the marketplace. And we started with Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Lakota Indian Reservation. The average life expectancy for a male on Pine Ridge is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time, 60% of the residents of Pine Ridge have neither electricity or running water. Many of them live in sod huts. This is the United States. And yet, of course, we have rendered the poor invisible, courtesy of corporate systems of information. What happened, I think, with the destruction of these movements, of people of conscience, even within liberal institutions being pushed out, is that we gave rise to what I would call a faux liberalism, embodied in a figure like Clinton, who spoke in that traditional feel-your-pain language of liberalism and yet betrayed the very constituency he claimed to represent. And that is how we got NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948, which makes it very hard to unionize. That is how we got the destruction of the welfare system. And let's never forget that 70% of the recipients in the traditional welfare system were children. That's how we got the deregulation of the FCC. That's not a small issue, because it allowed a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Clear Channel, to control the airwaves. And narrow political debate, it's all the same court gossip. It doesn't matter whether you go to MSNBC or Fox. It's just spun differently. But it's all empty. It doesn't touch the issues that matter for the majority of Americans. And that, of course, under Clinton, is how you got the deregulation of the banking system, which precipitated not only the national but the global financial crisis. And now, at this point, we've reached a stage in American history where we can't control these corporate forces. I mean, corporate capitalism is different from the penny capitalism of the farmers in the farm town where I grew up, where they brought their produce in and sold it. It's different from regional capitalism, which is the capitalism of the small business owner, the hardware store owner who sits on the school board and lives in the community and pays taxes. Corporate capitalism is supranational. It has no loyalty to the nation state. And that's how, after NAFTA, we could go to manufacturing centers and see literally factories crated up and shipped over the border to Mexico. And now there's large-scale closures in Mexico as they play one country off of another. And workers here throughout the world are told that they have to be competitive in a global marketplace, which of course means being competitive with prison labor in China or sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour. That's the creation of neo-feudalism, not only on a national level, but on a global level. And we have no mechanisms now by which we can fight back. Unions are largely spent and broken forces. You watch the courageous struggle of the teachers in Chicago, and they had to do it without the support of traditional labor and without the support of the Democratic establishment. That's putting it nicely. And that's the new world that we've created. We're on our own. The reason we began with Pine Ridge is because that's where the whole demented project of ceaseless economic exploitation and expansion began. Because what the force, the driving force behind the decimation of native communities, just like, of course, the driving force behind slavery was profit, the profit of a tiny white oligarchic class. So you had the railroad magnates, the timber merchants, the gold merchants, who saw native communities as an impediment, and by wounded knee, by the turn of the 19th century, 95% of indigenous communities in North and South America had been killed, had been obliterated by either violence or disease. I also think there was something else at work in the destruction of these native communities, and that is that they offered a competing ethic, that capitalism is essentially defines itself not by what it is, what it's for, because what it's for is selfish and immoral, but what it stands against. And within indigenous culture, you had a communal aspect. Indigenous leaders who hoarded for themselves would have been despised. Everything was shared. And there was also an understanding in the culture of that life, all life, was sacred. Carl Pogliani in 1944 writes a book called The Great Transformation that I admire very much, in which he talks about the nature of unfettered capitalism. And he said that in the book, although he's an economist, he uses the word sacred. He said that when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when nothing has an intrinsic value but solely a monetary value, then that society, which commodifies human beings and commodifies the natural world, exploits what it sees and defines as commodities until exhaustion or collapse. That's how you get the response on the part of corporate forces to the melting of 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice. For them, it's a business opportunity. Shell Oil going up there and dropping $500 million on drill bits to mine the last vestiges of fish stocks, oil, gas, minerals. It's insanity. It makes Herman Melville's Moby Dick the most prescient study of the American character. We're all on the Pequod, and Ahab's at the helm. And as Ahab said, you know, my methods and my means are sane, only my object is mad. The ability of fossil fuel industries to treat the environment like an open sewer. And, of course, the worse it gets, whether it's with the tar sands, whether it's with fracking, whether it's with shale, you can't just drill down, straight down anymore and get energy, means that the process by which they seek to make profit and sustain profit accelerates both the environmental and, finally, the economic deterioration. And I think that competing ethic, I went to the Princeton University Rare Book Room to take out Karl Marx's notebooks, which are never been published, because I had heard, and it's true, that he makes detailed studies of the Iroquois, how they govern themselves, you know, how they structured their society, and I think Marx understood that there were other ways to create human community, which wasn't built on this concept of exploitation. We went from there to Camden, New Jersey. Per capita, the poorest city now this year on record, without question, to be the most dangerous per capita city in the United States. What was the response? What has been the response in the last few weeks? The city has fired its entire police force because it's unionized. And they've replaced it with a countywide force which is non-union, which earns 50% less. That's a window, because they can get away with it in Camden, of where they're headed. That's certainly what they want to do to teachers' unions. And that has a twofold object. One is, of course, to break unions and deny people lives which can provide them with benefits and pensions and any kind of job security. But the other is because these corporate forces... and let's be clear, I mean, anytime hedge funds are going into the inner city and expressing a deep interest in schools, it's not because they want to teach you to write and read. It's because the U.S. government spends about $600 billion on education and they want it. And they want to replace teachers with vocational, you know, instruction manuals that can be, you know, and there's a huge difference between teaching people how to think and teaching people what to think. And in a corporate society, you don't want to teach people how to think. You want to teach them vocationally about what their place is within that society so that they keep it. Camden is a dead city. There are blighted parts of Philadelphia, all sorts of cities. In Camden, everything went. And it's a microcosm of what's happened to us, what we've allowed to happen to us. In the middle of the last century, 36,000 people worked in the shipyards. RCA Victor was there. Campbell Soup was there. It's all gone. And we went from there to Pine Ridge, South Dakota. There you have the coal companies. That's the most minerally rich region in the United States and the poorest because they extract the resources, poison the environment, blow the top 400 feet off the mountains. We flew over it. Joe and I flew over it. It'll rip your heart out. It's just a wasteland, hundreds of thousands of acres. These are the lungs of the eastern seaboard, the headwaters of much of the eastern seaboard, huge billion-gallon impoundment ponds filled with heavy metals and toxic sludge. You walk into these communities and in these old hollows, everybody has had their gallbladder removed because the water is poisoned. You walk into the elementary schools and the nurse's office, it's just rows of little inhalers because of the coal dust. These kids can't breathe. This is what happens when you kneel before the marketplace. This is what happens when you allow the dictates of the marketplace to structure your society. And we finally go from there to Immokalee, Florida, where undocumented workers pick our nation's produce. And anybody who knows the history of Florida knows that slavery never ended in Florida, whether it was in the turpentine camps or whether it was convict leasing. That has been a long tradition in Florida agriculture since the Emancipation Proclamation, slavery in all but name. And what happens? There you have the perfect worker in the eyes of the corporate state, utterly disempowered, no legal rights. They show up every morning in collection points, hoping for work. They have to pay $50 in cash a week for a mattress in an old trailer, 20 to a trailer. If they can't pay it, they're thrown out. And there you constantly uncover, and this has just been true through Florida's history for generations, examples of slave operations. People held against their will behind barbed wire. We interviewed one worker who had been chained at night inside a truck, and all of the workers chained in the truck had been forced to defecate in the corner of that truck. One night, three of the workers punch a hole in the roof and escape. They go to the police. They raid the place. But none of the workers want to testify in court because these crew leaders threaten their families back in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala. One or two workers did. We interviewed one of the workers. We found him. He was. What happens when you can't pay that $50 is you sleep outside. So there's encampments. In this case, he was living under a mango tree because after he did testify, he was blacklisted. He would show up and none of the crew leaders would pick him. And as Bernie Sanders says of Immokalee, Florida, in the vast race to the bottom that is America, Immokalee is the bottom. That's where we're headed if we don't begin to rebuild movements as a kind of counterweight. And it's very clear that neither the Democratic or the Republican Party are going to help us. I think, like several writers that I admire very much, including Cornel West and Wendell Berry, Bill McKibben, and others, have come to the conclusion that civil disobedience is all we have left. When we began this book, it was always called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Revolt was conjecture. Then the Occupy movement arose, which I was very involved in. And I'm just going to read a little section of that. Cornel West and I did, in Zuccotti Park, we did a people's hearing of Goldman Sachs, in which it was broadcast live by a local radio station. And we invited teachers who had been laid off and people who had been foreclosed from their homes to testify. And then several hundred of us marched on Goldman Sachs, which is where this passage is from. Cornell and I came in early the day before, and we'd spent about 6 or 7 hours with the occupiers planning the day. And Cornell and I went out to dinner, and Cornell leaned across the table and he said, "Where are all these so-called intellectuals?" Too busy. And this is from that moment at Goldman Sachs. Faces appeared to me moments before protesters from Occupy Wall Street and I were arrested on a windy November afternoon in front of Goldman Sachs. They were not the faces of the smug Goldman Sachs employees who peered at us through the revolving glass doors and lobby windows, a pathetic collection of middle-aged fraternity and sorority members. They were not the faces of the blue uniform police and their dangling plastic handcuffs, or the thuggish Goldman Sachs security personnel whose buzz cuts and dead eyes reminded me of the Stasi. They were not the faces of the demonstrators around me, the ones with massive student debts and no jobs, the ones weighed down by their broken dreams, the ones whose anger and betrayal triggered the street demonstrations and occupations for justice. They were not the faces of the onlookers, the construction workers who seemed cheered by the march on Goldman Sachs, or the suited businessmen who did not. They were faraway faces. They were the faces of children dying. They were tiny, confused, bewildered faces I had seen in the southern Sudan, Gaza, the slums of Brazzaville, Nairobi, Cairo, Delhi, and the wars I covered. They were faces with large, glassy eyes above bloated bellies. They were the small faces of children convulsed by the ravages of starvation and disease. I carry these faces. They do not leave me. I look at my own children and cannot forget them, these other children who never had a chance. War brings with it a host of horrors, but the worst is always the human detritus that war and famine leave behind, the small, frail bodies whose tangled limbs and vacant eyes condemn us all. The wealthy and the powerful, the ones behind the glass at Goldman Sachs, laughed and snapped pictures of us as if we were an odd lunchtime diversion from commodities trading, from hoarding and profit, from the collective sickness of money worship, as if we were creatures in a cage, which in fact we soon were. Goldman Sachs Commodities Index is the most heavily traded in the world. The financial firm hoards futures of rice, wheat, corn, sugar, and livestock, and jacks up commodity prices by as much as 200% on the global market, so that poor families can no longer afford basic staples and literally starve. Hundreds of millions of poor in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America do not have enough to eat in order to feed this mania for profit. The technical jargon learned in business schools and on trading floors effectively masks the reality of what is happening. Murder. The cold, neutral words of business and commerce are designed to make systems operate, even systems of death, with a ruthless efficiency. The people behind the windows and those of us with arms locked in a circle on the concrete outside did not speak the same language. Profit, trade, speculation, globalization, war, national security. These are the words they use to justify the snuffing out of tiny lives, acts of radical evil. The glass tower before us is filled with people carefully selected for their polish and self-assurance that come with having been formed in institutions of privilege. Their primary attributes are a lack of consciousness, a penchant for deception, aggressiveness, a worship of money, and an incapacity for empathy or remorse. It is always the respectable classes, the polished Ivy League graduates, the prep school boys and girls who grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, or Short Hills, New Jersey, who are the most susceptible to evil. To be intelligent, as many are, at least in a narrow analytical way, is morally neutral. These respectable citizens are inculcated in their elitist ghettos with values and norms, including pious acts of charity used to justify their privilege, and a belief in the innate goodness of American power. They are trained to pay deference to systems of authority. They are taught to believe in their own goodness, unable to see or comprehend, and are perhaps indifferent to the cruelty inflicted on others by the exclusive systems they serve. And as norms change, as the world is steadily transformed by corporate forces into a small cobble of predators and a vast herd of human prey, these elites seamlessly replace one set of values with another. These elites obey the rules. They make the system work, and they are rewarded for this. In return, they do not question. We seem to have lost, at least until the advent of the Occupy Wall Street movement, not only all personal responsibility, but all capacity for personal judgment. Corporate culture absolves all of responsibility. This is part of its appeal. It relieves all from moral choice. There is an unequivocal acceptance of principles such as unregulated capitalism and globalization as a kind of natural law. The steady march of corporate capitalism requires a passive acceptance of new laws and demolished regulations, of bailouts in the trillions of dollars, and the systematic looting of public funds, of lies and deceit. The corporate culture epitomized by Goldman Sachs has seeped into our classrooms, our newsrooms, our entertainment systems, and our consciousness. This corporate culture has stripped us of the right to express ourselves outside of the narrow confines of the established political order. We are forced to surrender our voice. Corporate culture serves a faceless system. It is, as Hannah Arendt wrote, the rule of nobody, and for this very reason, perhaps the least human and most cruel form of rulership. Those who resist, the doubters, outcasts, artists, renegades, skeptics, rebels, rarely come from the elite. They ask different questions. They seek something else, a life of meaning. They have grasped Immanuel Kant's dictum, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And in their search, they come to the conclusion that, as Socrates said, it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. This conclusion makes a leap into the moral. It refuses to place a monetary value on human life. It acknowledges human life, indeed all life, as sacred. And this is why, as Arendt points out, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. The greatest evildoers are those who don't remember, because they have never given thought to the matter. And without remembrance, nothing can hold them back, Arendt wrote. For human beings, thinking of past matters means moving in the dimension of depth, striking roots, and thus stabilizing ourselves so as not to be swept away by whatever may occur the zeitgeist or history or simple temptation. The greatest evil is not radical. It has no roots. And because it has no roots, it has no limitations. It can go to unthinkable extremes and sweep over the whole world. There are streaks in my lungs, traces of the tuberculosis I picked up around hundreds of dying Sudanese during the famine I covered as a foreign correspondent. I was strong and privileged and fought off the disease. They were not and did not. The bodies, most of them children, were dumped into hastily dug mass graves. The scars I carry within me are the whispers of these dead. They are the faint marks of those who never had a chance to become men or women, to fall in love and have children of their own. I carried these scars to the doors of Goldman Sachs. I placed myself at the feet of these commodity traders to call for justice, because the dead and those dying in slums and refugee camps across the planet could not make the journey. I see their faces. They haunt me in the day, and they come to me in the dark. They force me to remember, and they make me choose sides.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
One of the things I was very interested in, well, I guess the overriding thing in each of the chapters, Chris, is the structural problem that you put your finger on. Not, as you said, it's not just a polemic, it's not just a description. But for instance, starting with the Lakota children, to force them by Christian missionaries to speak English, to learn English, to do away with all of that superstition. In that chapter, you start with information we were sharing before we started the public presentation of how the guys in prison in New Jersey did not know certain things. In that chapter, for instance, you give such a wealth of information structurally showing how historically the promises that were broken to just in North America to the Native American people. Could you say some more about that? Because I'm not sure if everyone's had a chance you gave some numbers tonight in terms of those who were put on reservations or those who were left alive in Central, South, and North America, United States of America. But in terms of the legal things, like Michelle talks about legally,
yeah.
How a caste system has been created, legally what we did to the Native Americans.
Well, that becomes the mechanisms of repression, the law. So on the one hand, you have 400 treaties. Is this picking up? Yeah, on the one hand, you have 400 treaties that are signed between Washington and Native communities, and every single one is broken. And then despite that, you create through the judicial system, a process by which Native communities are, of course, originally corralled into what were called prisoner of war camps. Then they became tribal agencies, and then they became reservations. And I think the experience of what has happened in these sacrifice zones, whether it's on reservations, whether it's in places like Camden, New Jersey, or southern West Virginia, or anywhere else, is that what our neighbor went through in biblical terms, who we turned our back on, is now being done to us. That we forgot about Native Americans, we forgot about African Americans, we forgot about poor white coal miners, we forgot about those people in our produce fields, and the very forces that oppressed and blighted and in many cases destroyed these communities have now been unleashed within the nation itself. Mm-hmm. So in essence, what they are creating is a kind of reservation for all of us, a culture of dependency. I mean, what
The goal is to break the capacity for self-sufficiency and to destroy culture, to make sure you don't know who you are and you don't know where you came from. And we found in every single of these, and we did it statistically, went to the poorest places in the United States. Pine Ridge has the second poorest county in the United States. We found that people split two ways. They either descended into substance abuse, there's roughly an 80% alcoholism rate on Pine Ridge, or they found faith. And in Pine Ridge, it was traditional Lakota beliefs, sweat lodges, a recovery of Lakota language, and the Sundance, 4 days of fasting. I went to a Sundance around a cottonwood tree. They make small flesh offerings, very moving. And most of the men around that, in that 4 day ceremony, had gotten out of prison, covered with prison tattoos. That was true in Camden as well. And we profiled Lolly Davis. Lolly is just one of these, you know, in my mind, sort of examples of American royalty, these African American women who hold not only families and churches, but whole communities together, raises her fiance is shot and killed in an accidental shooting. There's a bar fight, which he's not a part of, and he ends up being a victim. She loses her 7-year-old daughter to asthma because they can't afford the medicine. She raises her own children, and then by the time she's now 70, she's taken in a total of 19 kids from the neighborhood, including a neighbor who was pregnant and was going for an abortion, and she said, "That's a sacrilege in the eyes of God. You give me that child, and I will raise it." And I asked Lolly, "You know, how do you do it? How do you?" And she said, "I never ask why." And I think that there is that kind of dichotomy within these communities. That was certainly as true as in West Virginia. So it's. I've never taken as long a break. We finished writing the book in January because, and Joe's the same. I mean, the stories, the pain that we confronted, and the utter indifference on the part of the wider community, and the way, as you point out, the patterns that we saw in Pine Ridge were replicated in Camden, were replicated in southern West Virginia because it's the same forces at work.
Is Lolly the sister you write about who, when the riots broke out,
yeah,
went? I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read the book yet, but she used the story of Rahab to put something red in the window so that your home would be protected, and it was not just for black neighbors. She went to her white neighbors,
yeah,
and said, "Put something red in the window so your home will be protected when the gangs come." Speaking of gangs. You mentioned in your presentation tonight that in New Jersey, the gang population is segregated by prison, yes, by gangs.
Yeah, so one prison will be Crips, one prison will be Bloods, one Latin Kings.
One of the shocking things for me, I never thought about it until reading this book, is that Native Americans are GDs. Did y'all know that? One brother got folks,
yeah,
tattooed across, mm-hmm, his chest. And that gangster disciples have a significantly large Native American,
yeah,
population. That the gang culture, and the gang for them is, that whole community, now that one's a dysfunctional,
right,
community, but it's a community and the notion of communal life as opposed to autonomous.
Yeah.
Autonomous life. One of the things that struck me immediately as I was reading that section of your book, and you described, and you did it again tonight, you described the difference between this competing, hoarding, me, I got mine, autonomous view of life as opposed to a communal view of life. The community is seen in West Virginia, is seen in Camden, is seen among Native Americans. And it leaped out at me immediately, as I was sharing with you before we came out together, about Alan Buzak, South African. The whole South African notion of Ubuntu, that community, that's how I get my identity. Now, it's dysfunctional when it comes to gangs, but I had a gangbanger say to me, you preachers talk about us, but you never talk to us. And a lot of our churches, when he brought me up short on, a lot of our churches, we talk about, we're getting ready to feed folk at Thanksgiving time. We go collect baskets and pass them. I did it for 36 years. How come we don't have gangbangers in the church? Because we don't want them in the church.
Yeah.
Why? These are some of the faces similar to the faces you saw in Sudan. These are kids who had no family, who had nobody to love them. So they went to this family. Did you run into much of that or see much of that in terms of your either teaching Lit Vac and Zen, Howard Zinn in prison, or in the Lakota people?
The book was sort of counterintuitive as a writer, so that the best personal narratives always gave to Joe to draw out, like Lolly or this 90-year-old miner, Rudy. But Mike Redcloud, he draws it out. And there you get the story exactly, as you said, of somebody who grows up without any kind of communal structure at all, including a functioning family, which is what alcoholism will do. And he finds that, or attempts to find that within the gang itself. And that surprised me. Wasn't until I got out to Pine Ridge, wasn't aware to the extent by which Native Americans had replicated the gang structure. As you said, I mean, even to the point of copying the names themselves. And then they'll pit one Native American gang against another. The part of the reason the life expectancy in Pine Ridge is so low is because of the number of violent deaths. A lot of it's traffic. Your huge number of traffic fatalities, but then also alcoholism itself. So, yeah, I think that, again, it goes back to that, that what Hannah Arendt calls the atomization, the way that, as we're essentially living within a society that disconnects us from each other, we are far more susceptible to despair and ultimately to manipulation.
One of the things that when you do Days of Devastation and you get to Welsh, West Virginia, that you talk about, in fact, it's a direct quote on page 129 of those of you who are getting the book tonight. I've read it in your Truth Dig articles. I've read it in several other places, Empire of Illusion. I think it's an eye-opener for many of us here, like Native Americans being Bloods or being Crips or being gangster disciples. Elected officials, state and federal, are paid employees of the corporate state. And then you go on and talk about its site, how much the Chamber of Commerce pays these congresspersons to vote certain ways, which is what produces that scene that you and Vaco saw flying over those mountains. Could you talk some more about how these people we're voting for are paid employees of the corporate state?
Well, I think as you, to steal a Jeremiah Wright line, they were selected. They were vetted. And I think the money shows it. And you go into a place like West Virginia, not only does Big Coal own every elected official and every judge and every newspaper, but they even write the textbooks in the schools to glorify Big Coal. So that resistance, and we saw heroic acts of resistance among activists in West Virginia, including we opened the chapter with Larry Gibson, who just recently died. When you descend to that level, the state is very good because people are so desperate in saying that those figures who resist are jeopardizing your jobs. So there's tremendous amounts of hostility. I mean, in the case of Larry, people are firing, shooting at his property. And another activist, Maria Gano, they killed the dog and left the family dog at the school bus stop where the kids went that morning to get their bus. That's the kind of pernicious logic. You see it played out in the attacks on unions where the line is, well, look at postal workers or teachers. They have pensions and benefits and you don't have them, so why should they have them? But of course, the question is inverted. The question should be, why don't we have them? And that's a very insidious but effective technique to manipulate oppressed people, so that the last readout of people who are able to actually sustain a family as the working class in this country once could on a single salary are they use those forces to essentially obliterate them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The you mentioned in your presentation tonight, you mentioned the New Deal and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and you keep dropping gems all almost every page that make people who have these images of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, labor unions, what? Almost like, what did your prisoners say? Damn, they lied to us. Page 196, where the migrant workers in Immokalee, Florida, left out of the labor protection put in place by the New Deal because of a backroom deal that Franklin Roosevelt made with Southern politicians who wanted African Americans kept out of unions.
That's right. That's right. That's why agricultural workers, that they were all denied the right to unionize. And, the state is nothing if not efficient about creating a mythology. But that mythology is not truth. And, I was just in Alabama. I'd never been to Alabama. I was in Montgomery. And it was quite disturbing to see the rise of neo-Confederacy. You drive into Montgomery now, and this is where it all began with King, and there's a gigantic Confederate flag. You walk through the streets of Montgomery, and there's one Confederate memorial after another to the flag. There's, it's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day is the holiday. They had done the year before a reenactment of the swearing-in of Jefferson Davis, where several hundred, Montgomery's half of Montgomery's African-American, a few hundred people dressed in Confederate uniforms had come to the Capitol to reenact. That was the original capital of the South. And it reminded me of Yugoslavia, because what it is creating not, they claim it's history, but of course the war is no longer, has nothing to do with slavery, it's all about states' rights. It's just an utterly rewriting of history into mythology and a celebration of a mythology. And that's very, very dangerous because, as I saw in Yugoslavia, you essentially have people within the same community who can no longer speak the same language because they're not actually building any kind of a discussion around truth. And that was the brilliance of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. That, many people criticized it because the white oppressors were given amnesty, but what it gave South Africa was a common narrative by which they could then communicate. And I was down there with a wonderful lawyer, Brian Stevenson, who spent his life defending death row inmates. And I told him, I feel like I'm back in Yugoslavia with the economic collapse and the retreat of a white underclass. In the case of Yugoslavia, it would have been Serbs or Croats, into an ethnic mythology. And of course, that mythology at its core is really as well a celebration of violence. And it's, in a time of crisis, that's a real powder keg. So, I think just as we've mythologized Lincoln and we've mythologized Roosevelt, and I think that's why Zinn's book is so important, that's a way of writing out the actual history, the struggles of all of those people whose names we don't know. We're talking about Ida Wells, the greatest journalist in America, without question. Ida Wells took on everyone. And including my old employer, the New York Times. If you know her, I mean, was she living in Birmingham? I can't remember where she was.
Memphis.
And there were lynchings, and she heard that, and she knew who was lynched. It was the store owner. It was all the people the white business community saw as a competitor and who they wanted to destroy. And then she read in the papers, including in the Times, the myth of rape. And she founded her own paper, which they eventually burned down. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, especially as we sever ourselves from a print-based culture, we become more and more susceptible to images and movies and that are, of course, in the end, funded by corporate interests. The voices of actual probity, courage, change are erased. And I think that the passage you read is a good example that, you know, that Roosevelt was a member of the liberal class in the sense that when, you know, when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement is that he saves capitalism. And that's right. That's what a liberal class does in a functioning democratic system. And without those movements, which we've largely lost, all of the counterweight, all of the pressure by which that safety valves work and by which the society opens up has been destroyed, which is why we see this constriction.
The I want to know, do you see any connection? I see a connecting of the dots between something that is uncomfortable to talk about. I just glanced past it quickly, talking about the gangbangers not welcome in our church, we don't want them in our churches. But going back to South Africa for just a moment, I was surprised, I guess 4 or 5 years ago, when Alan Buzak's Tenderness of Conscience and Running with Horses were published. That was the first time I read. I did not know anything at all because of corporate media. I did not know anything at all about what I call the prenup, the negotiated settlement. And as I talked to people on the study tours to South Africa and to people here in the city of Chicago and around the states, to find out how few Americans understood the only reason Nelson Mandela got out of prison was because of the negotiated settlement, the settlement that ended up with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the settlement that said, sign here if you want Nelson out of prison, sign here if you want apartheid to end. Sign here means we keep all the gold, we keep all the diamonds, right. We keep all the money, we keep all the military, all the police keep all the pensions, and you will not resort to violence, and we get X number of seats in the Congress. I don't care how long people stand in line for how many days to vote. The white Afrikaner party gets this many seats, plus we are going to make a black elite. We're going to call it the Black Economic Empowerment. We're going to make a handful of you all millionaires, and you keep them niggas in their place.
Yeah, well, that's what the civil rights movement.
I know.
It replicated because corporate capitalism got pressured, and it realized that it would, by accepting a black elite into its doors, it could still ultimately keep control, not only economic control, but for the majority of people of color, it could continue essentially. And Michelle Alexander has done a good job of this through economic and legal means. White supremacy could be maintained. And, you know, even Winnie Mandela has criticized Mandela for this. And I love Mandela. I admire him immensely. But on that issue, I mean, he had to reject the core economic program of the ANC, which was socialist.
Right.
And always had been socialist.
So you're 18 years later, you got a black elite, millionaires in
right.
South Africa, and a black elite, United States of America.
Right.
And 18 years after apartheid has ended, you have people who still don't have any homes. And you've got Camden, you've got Benton Harbor, you've got Pine Ridge in this country. With us meaning African-American churches, I'm not talking about my white counterparts in churches. By the way, Princeton University was the first, Princeton Seminary, pardon me, big difference, was the first seminary. In fact, Presbyterians started Lincoln University because Princeton would not allow blacks in. So that I know there's some socially conscious good Presbyterians, including my friends. But how, I don't know how we preach a gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't know how we call ourselves followers of King or of Thurman and buy into a prenup that allows some of us to be rich And we don't even talk to the poor. We're not even thinking about the poor, except we're going to give them some Thanksgiving baskets.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the issue. And unfortunately, by not standing up for economic justice, these forces have been able to distort and create a system by which I think it arguably, you know, life is not only becoming worse for the poor, but finally that assault, it's largely finished on the working class, is now being carried out on the middle class. And we know statistically that the first people to get dropped out of the middle class are people of color. They're the ones to go first. And I think, you know, one of my, and I was involved with the Occupy movement, but this was largely a white middle class movement. And these were kids who had been trained for positions of relative privilege and gotten out into the wider world, and there was no place for them. And suddenly they were experiencing what people in marginal communities had been experiencing for decades. You know, like police repression is new. Like foreclosures are new. Like unemployment or underemployment is new. And that for me was a failure of the white liberal class. That as this assault was being carried out by the corporate state towards the poor, towards the working class, they busied themselves with, I think, boutique activism, multiculturalism, gender politics, all which is good, but it was severed from justice. And they forgot the primacy of justice. And I think, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of bridges built because there was a lot of damage done. And I think, you know, my experience is there's a lot of distrust in marginal communities because they correctly say, well, okay, now you experience it and it becomes an issue. Where were you when we, for, you know, decades, have been enduring this assault? I mean, Camden is the worst. I've been to Watts, East New York, Detroit. Camden wins the prize. It is an immensely violent city because they all go over to Pennsylvania and buy guns. It's easy to buy guns. Whole blocks are abandoned. The only thing that functions are open-air drug markets, about 100 of them. And as you know better than most, those are internal colonies. That's what they are. They have very visible and invisible walls that make it utterly impossible for you to escape. And they'll break you, of course, through that prison system. I mean, for me, one of the most heartbreaking things about teaching in a prison is that there's always that, in every class, there's 4 to 5 kids, inmates, who are just so hungry to learn and so bright. And that nobody ever gave them a chance, ever. And I've taught at Princeton. I've taught at Columbia. I mean, these kids are brilliant. I mean, certainly in terms of native intelligence at that level. And yet they know, and I know, I mean, because they'll tell me, is that when they get out, they've got to check that box. And it's, you might as well put a brand on. And I mean, to be honest, there were just days I would just walk out and see this, you know, what a waste. I'm talking about our society, right. What we've done. And yet, you know, that kind of fervor, and it just, it'll kill you. And it's part of the reason I do it, and part of the reason that, I am in contact with these communities because, and I know this is something that's been very much a part of your ministry, is that it's very easy as a white male of privilege to make suffering an abstraction. And I don't ever want it to be an abstraction. I want it to be personal. Because when it's personal, not standing up is an act of personal betrayal. The people who, for instance, in that prison don't have the capacity to stand up.
Well, let me start with your quote, "Hope has a cost," page 266, in terms of genuine hope, not a mythology, not a soundbite, but hope for a change. You said at the close of, before you started your quote, that civil disobedience is our only option in terms of changing policies. How do we begin from your perspective, to start changing the policies. Dr. King, when he was assassinated, as you know, the year before he died at Riverside, was talking about capitalism, militarism, and racism. He died in the middle of a poor people's campaign, Resurrection City. He went to Memphis to stand with the garbage workers. That piece got dropped out somehow in terms of our concern as a nation, as a movement for the poor. And again, make a few millionaires, a few do a big blurb on Ebony about the new black middle class, and you get LeBron, you get Oprah, you get whoever, Michael Jackson, and what? No, we're not talking about individuals. How do we hold on to hope in terms of the policies that need to be changed? You, in terms of Zuccotti Park, now, I don't know how many, are you all aware of his lawsuit against the government? Thank you for that. I was amazed at how few people even cared about the NDAA Act, and that now the government has the ability to lock me up tonight with this forum that we're having and take me to Guantanamo. My family has no contact with me whatsoever. They don't have to bring any charges.
Right. Well, I think that what happened was, you know, I used to wonder, was Huxley right or was Orwell right? I think they were both right. First, we got Huxley. We got disempowered through cheap consumer goods and access to easy credit. Now the credit's gone and the goods aren't so cheap. And so now we're getting Orwell, the Iron Fist. And we see it in the way the laws are being rewritten. That's not new for black people, but now it's being rewritten for all of us to essentially criminalize any form of legitimate dissent. So we see habeas corpus is not restored. We see the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring and eavesdropping of tens of millions of American citizens, and all of that information is being stored, we now know, out in supercomputers in Utah. We see the use of the Espionage Act under the Obama administration 6 times to shut down whistleblowers. These are people, in the case of Sterling, the CIA official, who purportedly told the New York Times about war crimes and torture that were being committed. Now, the Espionage Act is our Foreign Secret Act. It's designed for people who give secrets to the enemy. Written in 1917, between then and 2008, it was only used 3 times against whistleblowers, the first time against Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers. Obama's used it 6 times. We see the interpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the executive branch of office the right to serve as judge, jury, and executioner in order the assassination of American citizens. And then we see, as you point out, Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which is a stunning piece of legislation to read. This is an act that says that those who substantially support, that's not even material support. Illegally, you know, as came out in the case, nobody really knows what substantially support means. Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces, whatever they are. And you can be arrested by the U.S. military on American soil, stripped of due process, and held, in the language of that section, until the end of hostilities, which is, in an age of permanent war, probably the rest of your life. And Judge Catherine B. Forrest in the Southern District Court of New York, in September, ruled in our favor, declared the law unconstitutional. Now, the reaction of the Obama administration, I thought, was very telling. We knew they'd appeal. They didn't just appeal. The day the ruling came out, they went to the judge and said, we need a temporary stay, which means put the law back into effect right now until the appellate court hears it. It's now in the appellate court. She refused, to her credit. So they went to the appellate court. It was now Friday night. And they said, we need an emergency hearing at 9 a.m. on Monday for an emergency stay and an emergency appeal. 9 a.m., they go into the court and they get an emergency stay, which means now the law gets back on the books until the appellate court rules. Why? Why did they react like that? And the only conclusion that the lawyers and myself can draw is that because they're already using it, that there are probably U.S. Pakistani dual nationals sitting right now, these are U.S. citizens, in places like Bagram. Because if the injunction was allowed to stand, the government, if they were holding American citizens in military facilities, would be found in contempt of court. And I think that, you know, these people are very, very busy in terms of rewriting the system. I mean, look at what Rahm Emanuel did in terms of rewriting the legal rules for any kind of legitimate protests in the city of Chicago. That's just been writ large throughout the country because they know very well what's coming. They know that, you know, without checking the fossil fuels industry's assault on our environment, you know, we just got hit with a hurricane. That's not going to be the last. And next time, maybe it'll be a Category 2. Our infrastructure is decayed and falling apart. We saw it in New Jersey. We can't sustain that kind of assault. Wait till the second or the third one hits. They know, as Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times has pointed out, that Wall Street's back to all the old games. I mean, look at the system we've created where the Federal Reserve, they just did a new quantitative easing, which is a fancy way of saying they printed $40 billion in new money and handed it to the banks at 0% interest. And we pay 15 to 30% interest on our credit cards. That's not capitalism. That's robbery. It is a system. It is a system by which, you know, and we're now about to go over the fiscal cliff, which nobody in power seems to be able to stop. And they're going to take it out on our backs. I mean, that is, they're going to push and push and push, you know, because they don't know any limits. Polanyi got that right. They don't have any self-imposed limits. They will push and push and push until there is some kind of a backlash. But I think, you know, what worries me is that because those of us who care about democratic openness and equality, because our movements have been so effectively destroyed, we may see that backlash coming out of that nativist, right-wing, proto-fascist element within society that I got a good glimpse of in Montgomery, Alabama. You walk down the streets of Montgomery, and there would be bumper stickers and on more than one car, and it would have Obama's face with a line through it, and it would say, "Time to go coon hunting." In the middle of the state capitol, and we have the most retrograde forces in American capitalism, like the Koch brothers and others, who are more than happy to fund it. My fear is that with the collapse of the liberal establishment, what we've created is political paralysis, the inability of the government to respond effectively to the rights and the needs of citizens. That's what happened in Yugoslavia: political paralysis. And you vomit up these very frightening figures on the fringe. When you look at the language of the Tea Party or the Christian right, it is a classic fascist agenda. They celebrate violence. They celebrate the gun culture. They fuse the iconography and language of American patriotism with Christianity. And they target the vulnerable: undocumented workers, Muslims, African Americans, feminists, homosexuals. There are a very long list of people they hate. And I don't take that kind of rhetoric lightly, because I saw in every war I covered that you first get people to talk in the language of violence, which is really the language of dehumanizing the other, before you get them to carry out acts of violence. Mm-hmm. And so for me, because I detest violence, I know it intimately, I threw myself into the Occupy movement because it is a nonviolent counterweight that seeks at least to recognize issues of justice. But the longer the state isn't able to respond, if we see the Obama administration, quote-unquote, cut deals with the Republicans to slash Medicare, cut back Social Security, this is what they're all talking about. We just saw the refusal to extend unemployment benefits for hundreds of thousands of American citizens, which means tens of thousands of these people are about to lose their homes. And a million people in this country a year go bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills, and 80% of them had insurance. The thing is, when you have insurance and you get seriously ill, they can jack up your premiums till you can't pay. I mean, what was the first thing that were the insurance companies demanded from the president after they passed the Affordable Health Care Act? It's they wanted exemptions to insure chronically ill children. And they got it, which means, in moral terms, we live in a country where it is legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters.
In terms of, well, you said you were a part of, you still are a part of the Occupy movement. Do you see the Occupy movement as the 2013 version of a mass people movement that goes after the changing the policies?
I think we have to look at the Occupy movement less as a movement and more as a tactic, mm-hmm. in the same way the Freedom Rides were a tactic.
Okay.
Paul Krugman, in column after column, writes that he wants the government to carry out a rational response to the economic crisis. Now, a rational response would mean a massive jobs program targeted especially at people under the age of 25, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of student debt, some kind of regulation and criminal prosecution of Wall Street. That would be a minimum. Medicare for all. That would be a rational response. Instead, the state responded by physically attempting to erase all of the Occupy movements. All of the grievances that pushed people into those encampments are not only there, but getting worse. And I think many people gave the president a second chance, but if the president doesn't deliver, if he continues to surround himself with figures like Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, if he continues to serve those corporate interests, then I think we will definitely see a pushback. My fear is that if there is some kind of a pushback, the sort of right-wing proto-fascist forces in this movement will mobilize the very forces that I mentioned before. You know, when you live in those kinds of systems, it creates a kind of dual system where you have the government on one hand essentially turning their backs on vigilantes. We saw it in Miami, for instance, within the Cuban-American community in the 1970s, shootings, bombings. And it was a way for, the government to essentially eradicate voices within the Cuban community that spoke about some kind of a reconciliation with Cuba and a more rational relationship with Cuba. And I worry that, my brief sort of time in places like Alabama, that with a kind of breakdown, that could be a kind of scenario that we'll see. But that something is coming. I mean, I've covered movements all over the world. I covered both of the Palestinian uprisings. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. I've spent enough time around the tinderbox to know that the tinder is there. What will set it off? It's always a mystery. No one knows. It's often something relatively benign or seemingly benign. But I have no doubt that something's coming.
Am I supposed to open up to this? What time? How are we doing?
Quarter of nine.
What time is it?
I had a question. You want to know the time? Okay. Ask it's quarter to nine. My question, Chris, you referred repeatedly to the Occupy movement, but can you call something that's existed for 1 year and is greatly reduced, that's what it is, a movement, and parallel that, what is a movement?
Well, a movement is essentially a mass mobilization outside of the formal structures of power that is able to put enough pressure on those centers of power to affect some kind of change. And I think that, you know, if you go back and look, for instance, at the civil rights movement, and not just the civil rights movement, but what came before. I mean, so much of what went into the civil rights movement came out of the Communist Party in terms of tactics. And that's why Ruskin, who had that kind of institutional memory, was so important to King, and why Hoover and the federal government was trying to sever that relationship. I mean, there were integrating lunch counters long before the civil rights. I mean, this, we were just talking about Rosa Parks. I mean, Rosa Parks wasn't just some woman who one day decided she was going to stay on her seat in a bus. I mean, these were people who had a deep political consciousness and a long sort of understanding of the structures of power and how to challenge them. So I think that the Occupy movement, it was clearly knocked off balance. I don't know what's coming next. I think that in many ways the Chicago teachers' strike was an example. Again, it was a grassroots movement. It was people on the community level trying to save their schools. And who were they fighting? They were fighting the Democratic Party establishment and traditional labor. And that very much is the kind of ethic of the Occupy movement. But how movements go, I mean, you know, you read the civil rights, it's not one giant trajectory. I mean, Albany, Mississippi was a terrible failure for those. And there are all sorts of times when the movement becomes so frayed, it's barely held together. Movements, by the end, are created by the ruling elite. They determined the configurations of rebellion. And I think because the ruling elite has not, in Krugman's word, responded rationally, then they've guaranteed that something is coming. But nobody, even the purported leaders of this movement or any movement, know what it is. I was in Leipzig on November 9th, 1989, with the leaders of the East German opposition, and they said, maybe within a year we'll have free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a matter of hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, no longer existed. They didn't know. And I guess I'll just close by saying that, you know, all acts of resistance create a kind of moral force, another narrative that keeps the possibility of resistance alive. And that was certainly something that I saw in Eastern Europe. You had weekly vigils in Leipzig led by Lutheran clergy, people walking through the streets with candles, and then suddenly 70,000 people joined them. So Erich Honecker, the dictator of East Germany, sends down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd. They refuse to do it. Honecker lasts another week in power. Václav Havel, I was every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with him in Prague during the Velvet Revolution. He begins Charter 77 in 1977. He writes his great essay, The Power of the Powerless, a year later, which is about living in truth, which your ministry has been an example of, and how that capacity to live in truth terrifies those within power. So that by, you know, when I was in Prague, all through the streets of the city, there were posters of a young Charles University student named Jan Palach, who, after the Soviets had invaded to overthrow Dubček in 1968, had gone to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire. 4 days later, he dies of his burns. And there's thousands of people. Of course, again, it's never covered in the state media. Carry his body to the cemetery. It's broken up by police. When his grave becomes a shrine, they exhume his remains, cremate them, give his cremated remains to his mother, and tell her she can't bury them. His poster was everywhere. 2 weeks after the Czech Communist Party fell, 10,000 people gathered in Red Army Square and renamed it Jan Palach Square. I was in Wenceslas Square with probably 500,000 Czechs on a December night when the singer Marta Kubishova came out on the balcony. She had been, before 1968, the most powerful or important singer in the country. She had sung the anthem of defiance that was played repeatedly over the airwaves to protest the Soviet occupation and overthrow of Dubček. Once the Soviet forces were reinstalled, all of her recording stock was destroyed, and she was never allowed to be heard on the airwaves again. She had spent the intervening years working on the assembly line of a toy factory. And she walked out that night and began to sing that anthem. And every Czech in the crowd knew every word. And I think that, you know, and this is, you know, why I find your ministry so important, it's so powerful, that in the end, you know, the act of rebellion is a moral act. And that, as my friend Father Daniel Berrigan says, you know, we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we have to let it go. Faith is the belief that it goes somewhere. Faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call it karma. Maybe all of the empirical evidence around us points otherwise. But faith is the belief that truth and justice and the ability to stand for truth and justice finally, in the end, triumph.
Can you please join me in thanking Chris Hedges for...
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.